Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, seven food aid workers with the World Central Kitchen were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. Despite coordinating movements with the IDF, the convoy was hit as it was leaving the Deir al-Bala warehouse, where the team had unloaded more than 100 tons of humanitarian food aid brought to Gaza on the maritime route, according to the WCK. Dimi Ryder, who writes for Haaretz and other publications, tweeted, "Security sources who spoke to Haaretz disclose a harrowing detail. The drone bombed the convoy three times in succession. The team survived one hit and tried taking cover in another vehicle, and then survivors moved to a third and were finished off there. Deliberate, repeated targeting of the convoy, making sure no one was left alive. Videos and photos show dead bodies and passports from Australia, Poland, and Britain. A Palestinian driver was also killed. Yesterday, World Central Kitchen founder Chef Jose Andres wrote on Twitter, "The Israeli government needs to stop this indiscriminate killing. It needs to stop restricting humanitarian aid, stop killing civilians and aid workers, and stop using food as a weapon. No more innocent lives lost." Palestinian journalist Hind Kudari tweeted from Gaza, "It is sad. This will have a major negative impact on the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Everyone is going to give up on us." World Central Kitchen says it will pause operations immediately in the region. Quote, "We will be making decisions about the future of our work soon," end quote. ANERA, which runs the second largest humanitarian operation in Gaza after UNRWA, just announced that it is taking the unprecedented step of pausing its humanitarian operations in Gaza. An announcement says the killing of WCK humanitarians occurring less than a month after the still unexplained killing of ANERA staff member Musa Shawa, alongside the loss of numerous other aid workers and their families, has led our team to conclude that delivering aid safely is no longer feasible. This comes as at least 30 Palestinians, including 24 children, have died from starvation and dehydration. The World Central Kitchen killing also comes as Israeli troops withdrew from the Al-Shifa hospital after a two-week assault, leaving dead bodies on the ground and Gaza's largest medical complex in ruins. It's been completely destroyed. Over 400 Palestinians were killed and over 1,000 homes in the area were destroyed, according to reports. Only two hospitals are now barely functioning, according to the UN. Sky News' Palestinian camera crew entered Al-Shifa Hospital and found horrific conditions.
Everything and everyone is filthy. There's no water, no electricity, no medicines. Nothing apart from perhaps the will to survive. "I can't speak," says one boy. "He was hit in Hamad Street," his relative explains. "Both his legs are injured. The child had no treatment for 15 days. The bones in his leg have started to bond. They'll need breaking all over again." The patients who survived are in an atrocious condition and speak of constant shooting and bombings and fear upon fear of suffering, which is even worse than this. "The doctors kept on moving us," he says. "They were forced to by the army. If they didn't obey quickly," he says, "everyone would be shot in the hospital." Much of the carnage in and around the hospital is too graphic to use under the licensing rules governing TV broadcasting, but they appear to show emaciated and burned bodies, including of children, and bodies which appear to have been crushed by heavy vehicles. One British-Palestinian doctor who worked at Al-Shifa told us he believes a fellow surgeon there was killed by Israeli snipers.
"His body and that of his mother were found dead, executed by Israeli snipers in the vicinity of Shifa Hospital. This was a young surgeon with a young wife, kids, two kids under the age of five. It is such an incredible waste of human life."
The Israeli military has distributed images of what it says is the battle for Al-Shifa, a hospital they continue to insist was a command and control center for Hamas, without producing evidence. The military's latest images showed what they say are arms and weaponry that they discovered inside the hospital. And past and present prime ministers have applauded it as one of the army's most successful operations, killing scores of fighters and insisting the damage was done by Hamas.
So the idea that someone who commits genocide is incapable of committing perjury or lying is ludicrous. These people have killed 14,000 children. 14,000 children. If they had killed 14,000 puppies or kittens, the world would have been outraged. The fact that these are 14,000 children seems to kind of not bother the majority of this planet. These people belong in the International Criminal Court.
Thanks to Sky News's Palestinian camera crew for that clip. And of course, Sky News. Israel still refuses to allow international journalists to report independently from Gaza. Palestinian journalists are working around the clock to get the videos and the images out to the world. They have been doing this for many months now, and 90 Palestinian journalists have been killed. The doctor you heard there was British Palestinian reconstructive surgeon Ghassan Aboutsita. He spent over a month treating patients at Al-Shifa Hospital. He was on Democracy Now! Yesterday.
I'd like to start by paying tribute to my friend and colleague, Dr. Ahmed Al-Maqadme, a young, brilliant plastic surgeon with whom I had worked at Shifa during this war and at Al-Ahli Hospital. And I'd worked with him before during the 21 war and during the Marches of Return. His body, alongside that of his mother, were found today when the Israeli troops withdrew, and they had been executed by the Israeli army while trying to escape Shifa. Dr. Ahmed was a brilliant and dedicated young surgeon who had won the Humanitarian Fellowship of the Royal College of Surgeons of England. And it's critical that we remember their names and we remember their stories. And today I want to send my love to his wife and to his children, both under the age of 5, who are now left without a husband and a father, along with so many of my colleagues who we've lost. This is the second plastic surgeon who I had worked with at Shifa, who has been killed by the Israelis, and over 345 doctors and nurses and paramedics who've been killed by the Israelis, intentionally targeted. Now, with regards to Shifa, Shifa was 30% of the capacity of the health system in Gaza. And so the destruction of Shifa, the wanton destruction of Shifa, is a critical component of Israel's plan to genocidally make sure that Gaza becomes an uninhabitable place even after a ceasefire happens. By destroying Shifa and making sure that it is irreparable, the Israelis are trying to make sure that for years to come, Gaza does not have a functioning health system. Shifa now needs to be completely demolished and a new building and a new hospital built, which means you're looking at 3 to 5 years once the building starts. This is part of the genocidal machine. But for me, as someone who has, you know, I reached Shifa Hospital on the 10th of October, on the morning of the Tuesday, and was in Shifa on and off throughout my whole 43 days in Gaza. It is not just the Israeli soldiers and the Israeli leaders, the genocidal tip of the iceberg that I blame. I blame the Western journalists who perpetuated the narrative that militarized the hospital as a justifiable and an acceptable target to the Israelis. These genocide enablers, these Western journalists, from the very beginning, peddled these stories that the Israelis were feeding them about Shifa being on top of this massive complex of command and control center. And their job was to enable the genocide to take place. And the genocide can only take place if the health system is destroyed. And so their hand, blood of my friend, blood of Ahmed Maqadmi, is on the hands of the CNN journalists and the BBC journalists and the ITV journalists who, from the very beginning, were peddling this narrative.
That was British-Palestinian reconstructive surgeon Ghassan Abu Sita, who spent over a month treating patients at Al-Shifa Hospital. Thanks to Democracy Now! For that clip. Yesterday, Dr. Abu Sita tweeted that he received a message from a colleague in northern Gaza about what happened at Al-Shifa. He received many testimonials from medical staff inside. He writes, 107 patients, most of them are severe cases. 60 of the medical staff have been incarcerated in an old building in the hospital that does not have the capacity to host such a number of patients or equipment. The situation was horrific and inhumane. No ventilation, cleaning conditions, water, nor minimum medication has been provided, leading to septic wounds with white flies out of them. Doctors said they ran out of gloves, so they started using plastic bags when changing wounds, which also ran out. They report the lack of elderly diapers, especially 30 patients are bedridden, and they use the diapers in intensive need of medical care. He also wrote that there was a limited number of staff. Patients' companions were either executed, arrested, or displaced to the south by the military, which adds another burden on the staff. The military is starving the besieged patients and staff with no food or drinkable water provided for days. The staff tried multiple times to convey their needs to the military leadership. However, he was met by violation and mistreatment. So this is a report from Ghassan Abu Sita, who is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon in Gaza. He also tweeted because he saw so many amputees, and we did a show about this in January. More than 1,000 children in Gaza have lost one or both legs since October. And Dr. Abu Sita said that anesthesia is not even available. And we did a show with Save the Children, and they also talked about the fact that anesthesia is not available. Dr. Abu Sita says child amputees of Gaza will need new prosthetics every 6 months and 8 to 12 more surgeries before they reach adulthood, as their bones grow faster than the tissue and the nerves surrounding them. Many of these children will face this torture as orphans with no surviving family. He also said that he treated a number of children, and they have no idea if their family is alive or not, if they still have family. So there are a lot of children with no family. We are going to be connecting soon with our first guest, Palestinian writer Susan Al-Buhawa. We should also mention that last week, the Biden administration signed off on even more warplanes and weapons for Israel, including 2,000-pound bombs. This is according to the Washington Post, and you can find that story at yourcallradio.org. Joining us is Susan Al-Buhawa, a Palestinian poet and author of the novel Against the Loveless World. She's also founder of Playgrounds for Palestine, a children's organization dedicated to uplifting Palestinian children. They're doing very important work in Gaza. Susan Al-Buhawa is also co-chair of Palestine Writes, the first North American Palestinian literature festival. She spent 2 weeks in Gaza last month and wrote a piece for Al Jazeera, which you can also find at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Susan, to be honest, I don't know where to start. We got the word about the World Central Kitchen. 7 aid workers were killed, including a Palestinian driver. We do not have his name. Otherwise, I would say his name. This comes just after Israeli soldiers left Al-Shifa Hospital, which has been just left in ruins. I mean, to see the video again, it's completely demolished. And doctors, patients, so many people were killed. where do you even begin to start?
Well, I think for starters, Western media, in particular, U.S. media, has to start calling this what it is. It's genocide. It's a campaign of extermination. I don't, you know, we continue to be gaslit as if we're not seeing and hearing and watching a genocide unfold. I mean, they continue to gaslight us even today with these with the WCK workers. So just so you know how the deconfliction works, they, you know, each organization, each aid organization puts in the names of each person who is going to be in the car. They put in the color of the car, other specifications, the license plate. They have a specific route. And all of this is submitted to the Israeli authorities. So they know exactly who they hit and when to hit them and where. This was a targeted assassination. And it's among hundreds, if not thousands, of targeted assassinations by Israel for journalists, for healthcare workers, for writers, artists, intellectuals across the board, any person who is capable of leading Palestinians to reconstruct their lives after the bombs stop falling. So this is, you know, telling the truth and not mincing words, not giving any credence to the lies that Israel continues to promulgate.
As we just heard from Dr. Abusita there, he said Gaza is becoming, well, it's in right now an uninhabitable place after the ceasefire. He says it's going to take 3 to 5 years just to build one hospital.
At least. And, you know, we heard Jared Kushner say, well, there's nothing really left to go back to. And he was talking about Israel, seizing it and turning it into valuable real estate. I mean, this is how these people talk. And I think as society, we have to start, you know, we have to start naming these things and naming these war criminals for what they are. And I would also start by demanding a congressional investigation into the Biden administration and all of these other AIPAC-funded politicians as foreign agents, because they are literally dragging the United States into an abyss, into a moral and political abyss on the international scene. So you know, that something... I believe that our politicians are compromised, and they should be investigated. For Biden to continue to approve billions of dollars in weapons to Israel, knowing what we all know at this point, but also having report after report after report from human rights organizations, from the UN, from people on the ground, and still ignoring it. And what he approved, those 2,000-pound bombs, those are dirty bombs. Those are not precision-guided. And they are ostensibly going to be used in the so-called, Rafah incursion, that another sanitized term for a bloodbath in Rafah. And if those are used in Rafah, in what is the most densely populated spot on this planet at this hour, they are planning to drop these bombs. I mean, it is unconscionable that our president is doing that. And there's no explanation other than that this man is compromised. Either he has lost his ability, his cognitive capacity, or he's compromised. And which either case, he needs to be investigated. This is not okay. This is the moment of our time in which humanity is breaking apart. There are so many other issues in the world. Yes, it's true. But at this hour, Gaza is the moment of truth. And as a society, we have to choose if we allow these monsters to continue what they're doing, and worse, to get away with what they're doing.
to your point about the Biden administration signing off on even more weapons, including those 2,000-pound bombs, Josh Paul, the State Department employee who resigned, he's been on the show. He was on Democracy Now! This morning, and he said that the United States has not been seeking assessments from the intelligence community of Israel's actions. It's essentially sticking its fingers in its ears and saying, we don't know what's going on. He says it's making a purposeful decision to, quote, not know what's going on. He says he's never seen anything like this in his time in government.
Yeah. I mean, we all see it, right? We see it at the press briefings when, you know, you have one reporter after another, you know, posing pointed, legitimate, urgent questions to the White House spokespeople and the State Department spokespeople. And inevitably, every single time they say, well, we're going to confer with our Israeli colleagues and get back to you. Of course, they never get back to anybody. And then the Washington Post article confirmed as well that the intelligence community had provided Biden with evidence and assessments that Israel was committing war crimes a long time ago, and he continued to turn a blind eye. So something profound. Something really treacherous and is happening in the American political arena, and I believe that a lot of our politicians are compromised. We all know that Jeffrey Epstein was hard at work. And, you know, I'm not, you know, this is common knowledge at this point that he was working for the Mossad and his operation was a honey trap. Who knows what, you know, what blackmail material this is. It's hard to understand the actions of our politicians at this hour, both from a political level, from a economic level, from a domestic politics level, from an international politics level, and most of all, from a moral standpoint. I mean, this country has done a lot of immoral things, but nothing ever so explicit and blatant. Even, you know, it's always like they will do what they want to do until it's public knowledge, and then they have to retreat and retract and make excuses and whatnot. But that we don't see that happening. The Democratic base overwhelmingly, something like, you know, 78% at this point, disapprove of what Biden is doing, and he's continuing to do that. I mean, that makes no political there's no political logic in that. And I really, truly believe that there has to be an investigation in this. The American people really need to wake up and try and understand how this country is being run and who is running it. And because it's certainly not a democracy. It's certainly not the will of the people. The will of the people is not being implemented in any shape or form. And what's happening in Gaza is an inferno. It is the seven layers of hell. It is beyond description. I have no words, honestly. I'm a writer. I'm a merchant of words, and language fails me. It fails to capture the enormity of the agony that is happening in Gaza right now. And it will not stop. Even if the bombs stop right now, hundreds of thousands of Gazans are going to continue to die from a whole host of things. When I was there, hepatitis, there's a massive outbreak of hepatitis. Children are dying from diarrhea because they're forced to drink polluted water. Diabetics are dying because Israel is explicitly not allowing insulin in. It's these details that the people of the world need to understand, that Israel, the details of their genocidal campaign. It's not just the killing. It's not just, and this targeted killing, by the way, is precisely to get the result that they just got, which is to have the WCK cease operations and to have ANERA cease operations. They've already shut down the UNRWA. So the three major organizations in Gaza who are keeping at least people on the brink of life, at least not, you know, in the South, at least in the North, they're just dying of starvation at this point. But these three major organizations are the only ones left, and Israel has succeeded in shutting them down. So this is targeted. This is an orchestrated famine. It is an orchestrated genocide. It is an orchestrated extermination campaign because they are greedy colonizers who want the land and they want the gas offshore. That is the reason. This has nothing to do with Hamas. They have stated for the past 20 years, at least, they have talked openly about eliminating Gaza in one way or another. And they have tried. That's the whole basis of this siege in Gaza. You know, I'm sorry. I know I sound animated and it is hard to subdue the horrors that one sees every day and that I lived with for at least, you know, 2 weeks while I was there. And like I said, the numbers of the casualties is a massive, massive underestimation mm-hmm. of the true casualty number, because it does not include all of the people who are dying slowly under the rubble or who were not retrieved from under the rubble. It does not include the people who are dying left and right from hepatitis, from diarrhea, dehydration. It does not include the people who had cancer, the cancer patients, the diabetes patients, the dialysis patients who have died en masse because Israel is not allowing in medications. I mean, and the numbers alone are horrific, but the reality is truly, truly unfathomable. And I cannot stress enough that this just has to stop. We have to, all of us collectively and individually have to find a way to make this stop and to hold these war criminals, these monsters accountable. This is a deliberate act.
Susan, before we let you go, can you tell us about what you experienced in Gaza? You say that it's very important to point out, I mean, we can say 32,000 people have been killed, and that is horrific, but you say it's so important to talk about the daily dismantling of people and their dignity, to think that people cannot shower, they don't have a place to sleep, some people have one set of clothing, that there is no normalcy. Can you talk about that before we let you go?
Absolutely. And thank you for mentioning that, because it is a complete dismantling of society. It is the reduction of a proud, high-functioning, highly educated society, despite all odds, that has been prosperous, despite sieges and constant bombing. They have managed to be resourceful. But Israel has intentionally reduced them to the most basic impulses of needing just shelter, water, and food. People having zero privacy, no access to sanitation, no shoes, sand and everything, and they're having to shave their heads because of rampant lice and hundreds of people sharing a single toilet that isn't really a toilet. The indignity, the sheer humiliation and indignity that people are forced to live with is unconscionable, and it's unforgivable. It is unforgivable. And I will tell you, and we can end with this, that after seeing what I have seen in Gaza, I am dedicating the rest of my life to this moment, to this hour, to holding people accountable and being there to liberate Palestinians from these genocidal, pathological colonizers, the whole lot of them, the whole society that is celebrating this ineffable suffering after they commit it.
Susan Al-Buhawa is a Palestinian poet, author of best-selling novels, including Against the Loveless World. Founder of Playgrounds for Palestine is a children's organization dedicated to uplifting Palestinian children. They are doing such important work on the ground in Gaza. She spent 2 weeks in Gaza last month, and you can read the piece that she wrote for Al Jazeera and other publications at yourcallradio.org. Susan, thank you for joining us, and we just got a couple of emails from people who said thank you for joining us and thank you for speaking up.
I appreciate the time you gave me. Have a good day. Thank you.
Coming up after a break, we will speak with Mosab Abu Toha, a Palestinian poet and founder of the Edward Said Library, Gaza's first English language library. He recently wrote a piece for The New Yorker, My Family's Daily Struggle to Find Food in Gaza. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we'd like to welcome Mosab Abu Toha to the show. Mosab is a poet, scholar, librarian, author of Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, and founder of the Edward Said Library, Gaza's first English language library. He wrote a couple of pieces for The New Yorker recently. A New Yorker contributor detained by Israeli forces is released, and another one, My Family's Daily Struggle to Find Food in Gaza. Hi, Mosab. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose, for hosting me.
Well, Mosab, I just want to get your thoughts about what has happened just in the last couple of days with the aid workers who worked with the World Central Kitchen, including a Palestinian driver. Seven were killed by an Israeli strike. This comes right after Israeli troops withdrew from the Al-Shifa hospital. This is a massive medical complex. It is now in ruins. Dead bodies were found on the ground. I mean, the footage is just horrific. You've been putting videos and various things on social media. I mean, what are your comments about all of this? Where do you want to begin this conversation?
Well, I'm talking to you from Cairo. I was able to leave Gaza on December the 3rd with my wife and three kids. In the third week of the ongoing genocide, our house was bombed in Beit Lahia, North Gaza. Luckily, none of my family were inside the house at the time of the bombing. 1 month after the bombing of our house on November 19th, I was on my way traveling from North Gaza to South Gaza, heading to the Rafah border crossing with my wife and three children, when I was kidnapped by the Israeli army, where I was blindfolded and handcuffed and tortured and stripped naked of my clothes in front of three soldiers, without me knowing where they were taking me or whether they were going to kill me, and without knowing whether my wife and three children were alive during the time I was kidnapped. I was kidnapped for 3 days. And if it wasn't for the international pressure put by some major American and European magazines and news agencies, I don't know what would be happening to me. What happened yesterday is that Israel banned Al Jazeera from covering about what is happening in Gaza and elsewhere. And a few hours after that, the Israeli army targeted three vehicles that belong to the World Central Kitchen in Deir al-Balah, to the southern part of the Gaza Strip. And if you read the article that was published today by Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, the Israeli army targeted the first vehicle under the suspicion that there would be a terrorist inside. And then when some of the people inside the first vehicle could leave and run to the second one, they targeted the second one, and then they struck the third one. So there was a deliberate attack on the World Central Kitchen. These people, seven of them, are international. They were risking their lives to support the Palestinian people in Gaza who were made to be starving for weeks. And they were killed in Gaza, and their flesh and their blood intermingled with the body parts of the Palestinian translator and driver who was in the vehicle with them. So Israel does not distinguish between Palestinians or international people as long as they are in Gaza. Everything in Gaza is a legitimate target for the Israeli killing machine.
When you were detained by Israeli authorities, can you tell us what happened exactly? What did they tell you? Why were you being detained?
I wrote about this horrible experience for The New Yorker I wrote about 6 pages, and listeners can find it online. It's called A Poet's Perilous Journey in Gaza. What happened exactly is that the youngest of our children is an American citizen. He was born in Boston. He is now 4 years old. So when October 7th happened, many countries encouraged their citizens and their immediate family members to apply for an evacuation. So our names appeared on the American list to depart through the Rafah border crossing on November the 4th. But just one day after we saw our names, we read the news that the Israeli army targeted a vehicle inside of which were a family just like us with American passports trying to go to Rafah from the northern part of Gaza. So we hesitated. So I tried to call the Red Cross office in Gaza. I talked to them. I told them, hello, my name is Mus'ab. I have an American son. I thought that would be, you know, a big thing for them. I told them that we have an American boy and our names are listed on the Rafah border crossing to leave Gaza. They said, well, we can't help with that. We cannot coordinate for individuals, etc. So that's what slowed down my evacuation. On November the 18th, there was heavy bombardment around the school shelter where I was staying in Jabalia camp. And in the same day, the Israeli army fired some gas bomb in the school where more than 4,000 people were staying in classrooms, including my family, my parents, and also my wife and their family. So that's when we decided to try and leave North Gaza and go to South Gaza before we cross at the Rafah border crossing. So November 19, I couldn't find a car, so I had to walk for a few hundred meters until I found a donkey cart. I traveled with my wife and 3 kids on the donkey cart until we arrived on the Salah al-Din Street. The Israelis were creating a checkpoint. So there were hundreds, maybe thousands of people trying to cross from North Gaza to South Gaza. There was a tank in the middle of the street, and that's there were 2 soldiers in the tank. I could see them with my bare eyes. And that was the first time in my life I see Israeli soldiers. On our left, there were about 10 or maybe 8 or 10 snipers pointing their guns at us. I tried to lift the American passport of my son along with our Palestinian passport, but I had the American passport in front. You know, I was waving the passport so the Israeli soldiers would see it. But unfortunately, no one saw it, and I don't know. Maybe they saw it, but they ignored it. It didn't mean anything to them. And what happened yesterday is another proof that it doesn't mean anything for them, whether you are an American or a Palestinian or maybe from another planet. It doesn't mean anything as long as you are in Gaza. Sorry. So as we crossed the tank, as we passed by the tank, we heard some Israeli soldiers shouting at us, ordering us to walk in line one by one and to look at them on our left. So they told us to lower our ID cards. They said, we don't want to see your card, just lower them down and look at us. And I later realized that was 3 or 4 days ago in an article written by the New York Times that the Israelis were using facial recognition technology. And that's how they spotted me and they took me out of the line, separating me from my wife and 3 kids. So they called me by description. They said the young man with a black backpack and a red-haired boy. So that was my American son. I was carrying him. Put the boy down, put your bags down, and come to us. That's when I dropped my son after trying to, you know, to approach the Israeli soldiers. I wanted to explain to them that, hello, my name is Mus'ab. Our names are on the list. This is an American passport. It's for my son, and we are clear to go. And as far as I know, and that's confirmed by many people, even international friends, that this list that is issued to arrive to cross through the Rafah border crossing is approved by the Israeli side, by the Egyptian side, and by the American side, or whatever embassy is, you know, allowing the citizens to leave. But I was kidnapped from my family. I was ordered to sit on my knees along with about 200 people before I heard my full name. I was surprised. How could they know my full name, even though I didn't show my ID? But that's what the technology helped them with. So they called me by my full name then, and then I had to walk outside of this line of people who were called before me. I had to recite my Palestinian ID number, which is created by the Israelis for us when we were born. And then after they confirmed it was me who they wanted, so there was no mistake about me or my name, they asked me later to get naked in front of 3 soldiers. There was another Gazan next to me who was also called to get naked in front of 3 soldiers. So 2 soldiers each pointing a gun at us behind a jeep. And the third soldier was holding his megaphone and giving us orders to take off our clothes. And then I remained in my boxer shorts. He said, continue, remove your boxer shorts. And after I removed my boxer shorts, I mean, I did not feel shy, although it was my first time being naked in the open. The young man who was next to me didn't look at me. I didn't really look at him. So after we got naked completely, he said, turn around. He wanted to see the back of me. And then after he confirmed that we were not carrying any weapons, or maybe we did not pose any threat to these heavily armed soldiers, they asked us to put our clothes back on, except for our jackets. And then they took the passports from us. They took the ID cards from us. They took our wallets from us. Even when one of the soldiers took my my wallet, there was an UNRWA ID card. I was an UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Works Agency employee. He said to his colleague, they were blindfolding and handcuffing us when he said that. He said, UNRWA. I said, yes, I'm a teacher. And then he said, hey, son of a, shut your mouth, son of a. And that's when I was threatened for the second time, after I was forced to be to get naked. And then I was led to a place where I was interrogated very briefly. They accused me of being a Hamas activist. I told them, do you have any proof? He slapped me across the face. So I was blindfolded and handcuffed at the same time. Mm. So the Israeli soldier slapped me across the face. He said, you get us a proof. And then that was before they took us in a military van. I did not see anything. I felt that it was a big van with some other kidnapped people with me. I later realized that they took us to Beersheba, South Israel. That was the first time for me to be in Israel. That was the first time for many, many people to spend the night outside of Gaza, because Gaza is under siege. There is no airport. There is no seaport. So there I was forced to stay on my knees for hours. And even when we were sleeping, we were handcuffed and blindfolded. And then the next day I had to sit with an Israeli investigator. He asked me a few questions. I told him everything about myself, about my travel, many trips to America, about my master's degree from Syracuse, about my prizes and awards, etc. And then he said, you are a smart person. We will see whether what you said is true or not. Before they led me back to the detention center, he said, one of the soldiers said, we are sorry about the mistake. You are going home. So that's it for them. They said, after 2 hours of investigation, they said, we are sorry about the mistake. You are going home. And by that time, I did not know whether my wife, whether my 3 children were still alive, because Gaza has been bombed for forever. I didn't know whether my parents were alive, or my siblings or children, their children were alive. We did not know what day or date it was. We didn't know. I mean, we couldn't pray even. When we were allowed to go to the bathroom, there was no water to clean. There was no toilet paper. I mean, it was a humiliating experience. But at least for me, I stayed there for 3 days. Now, there are people who are still kidnapped for about 4 months. One of them one of the people who were kidnapped from inside an UNRWA school in Beit Lahi is my wife's uncle. He was kidnapped from a school along with dozens of other young men like him. His name is Nassim Abu Shadig. He was born deaf and mute, and he was a father of two kids. The youngest is a few months old. He was taken from the school, just like me. I was taken from my family. And then the next day he was released. He went back to the school to reunite with his wife and two other small kids. By the time he arrived at the gate of the school, he was shot by a sniper and he was killed. But I can tell you that there are hundreds of other people like me who have been kidnapped, especially doctors and journalists and just people, I mean, teachers, I know, who have been kidnapped for at least 4 or 3 months.
We're speaking with Mousab Abu Toha, a poet, scholar, author of Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza, and founder of the Edward Said Library, Gaza's first English language library. Mousab, we're almost out of time. Can you tell us, how is your family doing? Because you're in Cairo, but you still have family in Gaza. And yeah. You wrote a piece for The New Yorker about your family's struggle to find food.
Yeah. Well, I left Gaza nearly 4 months ago, but I didn't leave Gaza literally. My father and mother, three of my siblings also, and their children are still in North Gaza, and I have two other siblings in Rafah in South Gaza living in tents. But my huge concern is about my parents and my siblings who are starving, right? Who are being made to starve in North Gaza. They are struggling every day to find food, especially this month, the holy month of Ramadan, when people are used to, sit around the same table and break bread together. Every week I would have my parents or my wife's family to share food with us in Ramadan. But people are now looking for, they are eating canned food. And instead of roasted chicken or some beef with rice and some vegetables and fruit and some sweets after the main meal. But people are now trying to find some food from the food that is dropped from the planes. I think 5 days ago, the planes dropped food aid in the sea, and 12 people were drowned in the sea. One of them is a neighbor of mine. So what the world is trying to do is dropping food to people in Gaza, some of which killed people like the one I mentioned when they drowned in the sea. Some of the food that was dropped from the sky fell in the people who were sitting in their houses. But at the same time, they continue to not drop weapons to Israel, but no, ship weapons to Israel, which in turn drops these weapons in Gaza. So I don't understand the logic of this world. None of us can understand what is happening in the world. I mean, instead of dropping food to Gazans, don't drop food to people in Gaza. Okay, drop food. But at the same time, don't continue to ship weapons decently to Israel, which would bomb the people and drop these bombs on people who are trying to find some canned food that you drop from the sky.
Mousab, before we let you go, we have just a minute left. I just wonder what your thoughts are about the future of Gaza's poets and writers and librarians. I mean, you're a poet. I've been reading about what sounds like an amazing library, the Edward Said Library. Is that library still standing?
I have no news about what... So the library has two branches, one in Beit Lahi, North Gaza, where I live in the past at least 25 years. And there is one new branch in Gaza City. And I don't know anything about the two libraries. I can't ask someone to go there and risk their lives to check on the state of the libraries. But what I know is that complete neighborhoods in the Gaza Strip were wiped out. Not only libraries, but hospitals and universities and the schools. I'm not sure if one of the Israeli soldiers went and saw the library. Maybe they said they found something that they did not like, or an author they did not like, and maybe the open file at the library because they didn't like a title, or maybe a poet, who wrote differently from the poems that they, if they were able to read. So I have no idea about the state of the two libraries. I have no idea about the state of my parents or my siblings. I mean, Gaza is not only under bombing. It's under complete blackout because Israel has bombed, I mean, lots of infrastructure, especially electricity, also communication companies. I mean, many days I lost contact with my family. I couldn't call them. And I still have difficulty in trying to call my parents because the network is down, is made down by Israel. They don't want people in Gaza even to talk to the other people outside.
Mm. Mosab, how many people have you lost, family and friends?
Oh, it's difficult to count. In the first few weeks, I lost about 30 people from my extended family. Mm. They bombed a house that was four stories. So I think there are still bodies. So it's been 6 months and there are still bodies under the rubble because there is no equipment to remove the rubble and extract the bodies of those who were killed. I have lost a dear friend of mine, Rifat Al-Arayil, who was killed with his sister and the brother and their children. I have also lost my friend Nasim Hamdouna, who was killed during the wheat flour massacre on the Rashid Street. And then the next day, I read the news that his whole family, his mother and father and sibling and their children, were killed under the rubble of their house. I've also lost my wife's uncle. I have lost also a neighbor of mine who had a really beautiful voice. You can go and check my Instagram. You would listen and hear to Rifat speaking, to Maruf singing, to Nasim, who was born deaf and mute, my wife's uncle, with some of his students, because he used to teach deaf and muted children in a school. Mm-hmm. I cannot count the loss, you know, and I'm so concerned that this loss will continue.
We're so sorry, Mosab, and I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us to share your story. Mosab Abu Toha is the author of Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. You can find the New Yorker pieces he has written at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much, Mosab.
Thank you, Rose, and to the listeners.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.